Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Did you know the Vatican had an observatory in Arizona? And remembering one of our better known English martyrs, St. Thomas More. Thanks for joining me once again. Well, did you know the Vatican had an observatory and that it's located in a part of the world which at first glance may not seem to have any obvious connection with the Vatican, a remote area of the US state of Arizona? What's more, on top of a mountain, as experts in the field of astronomy have known for decades, it's Mount Graham, the highest peak in the south of the state, dubbed sacred by some, on top of which the Vatican has perched a sophisticated telescope, thus establishing a research base that, for record's sake, moved out there from Castel Gandolfo in the hills southeast of Vatican City after light pollution began to hamper stargazing in the Rome area not so very long ago. A research base manned, as we speak, by a dozen or so scientists, most of whom Jesuits, who each day go on their daily rounds engaging in advanced astrophysics, cosmology, and galactic and extragalactic research. My colleague Susie Hodges was curious to find out more and got in touch with the deputy director of this Arizona observatory, Jesuit Father Chris Corbally, asking him all about this little-known outpost of the Vatican on American soil. Just listen.
Some people know us very well, and those are the friends who have been helping very much in building our new telescope out here in Arizona. Now, I suppose it's 12 years old, 13 years old coming up, so it's not so new, but it's still very active. Those who support us in that know us very well. Other people, yes, there's quite a surprise that the Vatican has such a scientific presence in the United States.
And why did the Vatican go about finding such a site in Arizona? It was to do with the pollution, the light pollution, wasn't it, in Castel Gandolfo outside Rome?
Yes, it was the increasing amount of light up in the night sky at Castel Gandolfo that brought us to Arizona. Just as in 1935, the increasing amount of light in Rome brought us from the hill in Vatican City out to Castel Gandolfo. So it's a kind of a regular process. But initially, we didn't come to build a telescope here. We came to relocate people to have access to the telescopes that were already here in Arizona.
The Vatican, as you mentioned, does have its own telescope. Tell us something about it. Is it or was it a state-of-the-art one?
Well, our telescope was an afterthought. We first moved people and established a second research base. That's in 1980. And then because of our presence here and because of the University of Arizona's interest and project to build giant new telescopes, then we were offered the mirror, which is the heart of the telescope that we currently have.
And how powerful is it?
Well, if you had it in your backyard, it would be very powerful indeed. But in astronomy terms, professional astronomy terms nowadays, it's a very moderate size. It is 1.8 meters in diameter for its primary or a main mirror, but that makes it a wonderful workhorse so that one can get a lot of time on the telescope and do a lot of survey and monitoring kind of projects.
Is it true that some Native Americans from the Apache tribe objected to Mount Graham being used as a site for stargazing because they consider the mountain sacred? Is this still a sore point?
There was objection. The first objections were environmentalists saying that we were going to destroy the habitat of the Mount Graham red squirrel, which is a subspecies of red squirrel. When it was seemed to be that when that became clearly not an issue, then some local Apaches, some, I have to emphasize, were encouraged to find opposition to our presence. Some of that opposition continues today because, you know, all mountains are sacred to Native Americans. And obviously some mountains are more sacred than others, and Mount Graham is the tallest one in the region. But it's sacred to some and not to others.
So there's not a lot of ill feeling still?
There is some ill feeling, yes. On the other hand, I have been up on the mountain with a group of Apaches, among whom was an elder, so one of the leaders of the people, and she was very appreciative of the presence of telescopes up on that mountain, which she used for her own, you know, sacred rituals. So I found there is not a uniform approach among the Apaches. Like many people, there are differences of opinion. And yet when they speak out, then they need to speak in a uniform way. So one sometimes gets the wrong impression by listening, you know, as it were, to the official viewpoint. When one talks to them, there is a variety of viewpoints.
Now, when it comes to the astronomers working there at the Vatican Observatory in Arizona, are they all working on slightly different projects, or are they all contributing to one grand one, as it were?
The old style of an observatory was there was one grand project that was the pet project of the director, and all the minions, the staff, help with that project. That's not been true of an observatory for quite a long time. So yes, all the members of the Vatican Observatory staff have different expertises and interests and different groups of collaborators. So all kinds of projects we are pursuing them.
And can you give us a very brief example in layman terms of one of them?
One person, Father Jose Funes, whose work is in galaxies. Galaxies are the collection of, in the order of 100,000 million stars, which dot our universe. Well, if you look out in the night sky, you will see the band of the Milky Way, which is actually the huge collection of stars in which our own sun is situated. So what Father Jose Funes is interested in, along with colleagues that work with him, is how galaxies have gone through their lifetime. And they have not been isolated from other galaxies. There's been interactions and even mergers, as if one big galaxy has made a meal of smaller galaxies. And the remains or the signs of that in the structure of how galaxies look at the moment. So that's a fascinating study of the history of galaxies in our universe. And Father Jose is using the Vatican telescope here, as well as other telescopes through the world, to explore this.
The church and science, of course, have had a somewhat troubled relationship at times, most famously in the 17th century when the church put Galileo, the astronomer, on trial for heresy for saying that the earth revolved around the sun. Do you believe that there's always destined to be a certain amount of tension between the two?
I think inevitably, yes, that there's going to be some tension between the church and science. Let's say not the church so much as religion or faith and science, because they can seem so different. And in a way, they are. But the importance is, you know, that they are asking a different kind of questions about us and God and the universe. And if one gets the distinction between the question that's asked, then no, there isn't a controversy. But if one is not clear about the distinction, one thinks that one should be dictating to the other. And no, that can't be. They have the separate regime of understanding.
So is it easy for you to keep separate your role on one hand as an astronomer and on the other that as a Catholic priest, say when you're teaching? I mean, you don't find any kind of contradiction at times between your two roles?
No, not at all. There isn't any contradiction when I teach science. I don't suddenly feel that I have to be bringing in some theology in order to support the science. The science will stand on its own and in its own methodology. And yet, the science will also raise questions that are theological questions that are, and so are answered through theology. So it's the raising of questions is possible, as well as the interaction of one's faith on the way, not so much the method that one does science, but the manner, the integrity of doing science, belief that, yes, the whole universe is rational and understandable because there is a creator. Created in an understandable way. So there is an interaction, and yet there's also a separation in the methodology or the discipline of doing, answering the questions of each theology and of science.
You talked there about creation, and of course there's been quite a lot of controversy in recent years between those who believe in the creationism theory or the intelligent design theory, which is an offshoot of that, or rather Darwin's theory of evolution. And I gather that opinion polls show that a large number of Americans are more inclined to believe in the more literal, shall we say, creationism theory or intelligence design. How do you explain that?
Explain the quite large, it's not a majority, but any quite large adherence to the biblical viewpoint of how everything started as a need for something that's secure, need to be assured of something. In the Catholic Church, our faith seems to be something that is very firm. There is the Bible, and there also is the 2 millennia tradition of people living the faith that is our foundation. Somehow I feel if you just concentrate on the Bible, without that sort of background of lived faith so much, then there is a big need to see the words of the Bible as literally true exactly in what they say, and that anchors one's own security.
So do you see in some ways your job as helping to bridge the gap between church and science?
Yes, the Vatican Observatory is a bridge between the Catholic Church and the scientific world. It's not the only bridge, because there's the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which is a scientific society in all the sciences that is that bridge. So yes, what the Vatican Observatory shows is that, first of all, there is no conflict between faith and science. But not only that, that's the negative. But also there's an enormous positive and fruitful relationship that is possible between the two when you've sorted out what each the areas are. What's the area of faith and theology, and what's the area of scientific inquiry. And then if you do that, there is an enormous fruitful area.
I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did, and would like to thank Jesuit Father Chris Corbelli for granting Susie Hodges this enlightening interview. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, on a total change of tone, we now join Jill Bevilacqua as she takes us back in time to mark someone rather special, one of our better-known British martyrs, St. Thomas More.
It is sometimes said that those who become martyrs receive a warning from God beforehand.
Of Thomas More, beheaded on Tower Hill in London in 1535, a story is recounted in the journal of his daughter, Margaret Roper, which suggests that he too had a presentiment of his tragic destiny. He was lying on the hay with his head on Margaret's lap. His eyes were shut.
Father, are you asleep?
Yes, and dreaming.
What are you dreaming of?
Of a far-off future day, Meg, when you and I will look back on this hour and this hayfield and my head in your lap.
Perhaps Moore thought he would become a martyr, but he certainly never sought martyrdom. He relinquished life most unwillingly, for he enjoyed it and asked no more than to be allowed to live in peace with his beloved family and many friends. This was not to be, and as Moore was a man of conscience, a man of integrity, and above all a man of prayer, he had no hesitation when forced to choose between God and man. He chose God.
Thomas Moore was born in Cheapside, London, in 1478. At the age of 12, he became a page in the household of Cardinal Morton, the King's Chancellor, who recognised the boy's qualities and predicted a great future for him, though he could hardly have guessed that Moore too would become Chancellor one day. After reading Greek at Oxford, Thomas was sent by his lawyer father to study law at Lincoln's Inn, and at 19 he was called to the bar.
Thomas became a brilliant lawyer, but he was also a scholar and the friend of scholars, and he entertained at his Chelsea home the greatest minds of Europe. He held advanced views on the education of women and inspired all his children, especially Meg, with his love of learning. A popular orator, a witty and merry person, his company was sought even by the king, Henry VIII, who made Moore his chancellor when Wolsey fell from power in 1529.
But Moore was an astute judge of men and had no illusions of where he stood with the king. He spoke of this to his son-in-law, William Roper.
I believe he doth as singularly favour me as any subject within his realm. Howbeit, son Roper, I may tell thee I have no cause to be proud thereof. For if my head could win him a castle in France, it should not fail to go.
Moore was not far from the truth, though it was not for a castle in France that he lost his head. In 1532, when Henry wanted to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn, Moore could not but oppose him. Moreover, Henry and his followers were passing bill after bill, abolishing papal rights and privileges, and confiscating church revenues. Moore resigned his chancellorship.
From that moment on, Thomas Moore was persecuted. He was essentially a public man, in words and actions, but in this, the greatest issue of his life, he was forced into silence and inactivity. Reduced to poverty, he hoped that by keeping silent, he would be left alone. But the confrontation came in 1534, when the Act of Succession was passed. In the preamble of the Act, the Pope's jurisdiction was repudiated. It was the point of no return, and Moore, together with Bishop John Fisher, refused to sign. He was committed to the Tower.
Moore had tried to prepare his family for his arrest by having someone knock on the door and call for him on several occasions. When the summons finally came, he allowed none but his son-in-law, Roper, to go with him. And to him he turned, saying, "Son Roper, I thank our Lord, the field is won." At the time, Roper did not understand Moore's meaning, that he had won his conflict with himself. No one, not even his family, could persuade him to change his mind. Friends of his who were members of the council did their best to shake his resolution in the hope of saving him. His wife and daughters were allowed to visit him for the same reason. Margaret, although she sympathized deeply with her father's position, did her utmost to get him to speak the formula which would set him free.
"You want me to swear to the Act of Succession?"
"God more regards the thoughts of the heart than the words of the mouth. Or so you've always told me."
"Yes."
"Then say the words of the oath, and in your heart think otherwise."
"What is an oath, then, but words we say to God?"
"That's very neat."
"Do you mean it isn't true?"
"No, it's true."
"Then it's a poor argument to call it neat, Meg. When a man takes an oath, Meg, he's holding his own self in his own hands, like water. And if he opens his fingers, then he needn't hope to find himself again. Some men aren't capable of this, but I'd be loath to think your father one of them.
So should I.
Then...
There's something else I've been thinking.
Oh, Meg.
In any state that was half good, you would be raised up high, not here, for what you've done already.
All right.
It's not your fault the state's three quarters bad.
No.
Then if you elect to suffer for it, you elect yourself a hero.
That's very neat. But look now, if we lived in a state where virtue was profitable, common sense would make us good, and greed would make us saintly. And we'd live like animals or angels in the happy land that needs no heroes. But since, in fact, we see that avarice, anger, envy, pride, sloth, lust, and stupidity commonly profit far beyond humility, chastity, fortitude, justice, and thought, and have to choose to be human at all, why then perhaps we must stand fast a little, even at the risk of being heroes.
But in reason, haven't you done as much as God can reasonably want?
Well... Finally, it isn't a matter of reason. Finally, it's a matter of love.
Moore did not believe himself worthy of martyrdom, nor was he at all sure that he would be equal to it should he be brought to the test.
Robert Bolt, who wrote A Man for All Seasons, from which this scene is taken, made this comment on Moore's stand.
He knew what area of himself he could yield to the encroachments of his enemies, and what to the encroachments of those he loved. But at length he was asked to retreat from that final area where he located his self. And there this supple, humorous, unassuming, and sophisticated person set like metal, and could no more be budged than a cliff.
Thomas Moore did not condemn the many others who signed the act, nor encourage any to follow his example. All he would say of the oath was, "This I am sure, that of those that have sworn it, some of the best learned, before the oath was required, plainly affirmed the contrary of such things as they have now sworn."
To Margaret he confessed his fear of pain, telling her that he was almost afraid of a fillip, and that his flesh was by nature much more shrinking from pain and death than he thought it the part of a faithful Christian man. Knowing that he might be put to the rack, Moore took the precaution of writing to a friend that if it should be heard that he had taken the oath, people would realise that he had done so only in weakness, and not because he had changed his views. Over 400 years later, Cardinal Mincenti, in the same situation, did exactly the same thing.
Moore was in the Tower for 15 months, during which time he maintained his silence, despite constant efforts on the part of the King's men to extract a treasonable statement from him. It was Richard Rich, a former member of Moore's household and now Solicitor General, who finally provided the pretext for bringing Moore to trial. Rich, who was a notorious time server, falsely reported a conversation he had had with Moore in the Tower.
Rich asked Moore if he would take him as King, if Parliament so decreed, to which Moore replied yes, since that was good constitutional law. Then Rich asked, "But if there were an act of Parliament that the realm should take me for Pope, would you not then, Master Moore, take me for Pope?" To this, Moore offered a question of his own. "Suppose the Parliament should make a law that God should not be God, would you then, Master Rich, say that God were not God?"
And at this point, Rich reported Moore had added, "No more could the Parliament make the King supreme head of the Church." Moore never spoke these words, but Rich testified against him in the witness box, and on the perjurer's false testimony, Moore was convicted of high treason. Before sentence was passed, Moore was allowed to speak. He knew now that there was no redress, and broke his silence at last.
"To avoid this, I have taken every path my winding wits would find. Now that the court has determined to condemn me, God knows how, I will discharge my mind concerning my indictment and the King's title. The indictment is grounded in an act of Parliament which is directly repugnant to the law of God. The King in Parliament cannot bestow the supremacy of the Church because it is a spiritual supremacy. And more to this, the immunity of the Church is promised both in Magna Carta and the King's own coronation oath. I am the King's true subject, and pray for him and all the realm. I do none harm. I say none harm. I think none harm. And if this be not enough to keep a man alive, In good faith, I long not to live. I have, since I came into prison, been several times in such a case that I thought to die within the hour. And I thank our Lord I was never sorry for it, but rather sorry when it passed. And therefore my poor body is at the king's pleasure. Would God my death might do him some good.
On July 5th, Moore wrote to Margaret, sending her the hair shirt he had worn for 40 years and telling her he was to die the following day. The king, fearing Moore's eloquence, had sent word that he was to speak no more than a few words from the scaffold. So Moore told the crowds that when he first accepted office, the king himself had given him the most virtuous lesson that ever prince taught his servant, willing him first to look unto God, and after God, to him. This, Moore claimed, he had done, concluding, "I die the king's good servant, but God's first."
Moore's last words were in perfect keeping with his whole life and character. He jested with the lieutenant of the Tower, charged the executioner to strike straight, and pulled aside the beard he had grown in prison, saying jokingly that it had committed no treason.
Thomas Moore was beheaded on July the 6th, 1535, a few days after Bishop Fisher. According to custom, his head was impaled on a pike on London Bridge. But Margaret bribed someone to give it to her, and she preserved it all her life. It is buried with her in the Roper Vault in St. Dunstan's Church in Canterbury. His body was first buried in the Tower Chapel and was probably transferred later to the tomb he had prepared in the church at Chelsea. During the London Blitz in the Second World War, the church was destroyed, but one thing was left intact, the tomb of Sir Thomas Moore.
Thomas Moore was a man who enjoyed living. As his friend Erasmus wrote, "There is nothing that occurs in human life from which he does not seek to extract some pleasure, although the matter may seem serious in itself." But when Moore was put to the test, he found something in himself without which life was valueless. His own act of self-validation turned out to be a martyrdom that he did his best to avoid, but that he had to accept if he was to see any coherence between the course of his life and its end. His death was not the headlong rush of a fanatical zealot into oblivion. It was the fearful, considered decision of a man of great self-knowledge, doing what he had to do, and wishing almost until the end that he did not have to do it.
And our thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for writing and presenting this programme focusing on the figure of St. Thomas Moore, and to Sean Patrick Lovett for producing it. Our thanks also to the speakers, among whom Sean, of course, and actor John Gayford. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. If you did, please let me know. Our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Or if you wish to drop me a line, the address is The English Programme, Vatican Radio, Vatican City. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.